ברוכים הבאים, רבותיי. Welcome to another edition of our Wednesday night class. Parashat Yitro, that's where we're up to tonight. Of course, Parashat Yitro is famous for the Aseret HaDibarot, the Ten Commandments. Tonight, however, we're not going to get to that, I don't think. Tonight, we're actually going to analyze some pisukim right at the beginning of the parasha. Actually, pisukim that are very unassuming, very pav pisukim that you might just read over very quickly, thinking to yourself, what in the world can I learn from these pisukim, and what can a rabbi talk for about an hour about three, about two pisukim that are basically just names? And the Torah says that when Moshe Rabbeinu was in the Midbar with the Jewish people, after the Torah was given, there were two Jews or three Jews that were not there at Matan Torah. And ironically, those Jews happened to be Moshe Rabbeinu's children and his wife. When the Torah was given that great momentous day, Har Sinai, and where's Moshe Rabbeinu's kids? They missed the whole show. His kids were in Midian with their grandfather Yitro, and they only show up after. So the Torah tells us of that reunion that Moshe Rabbeinu had with his father-in-law, with his wife, and with his two children. And the Torah says, Ve'et shene baneha, they came back with Moshe's two children, Asher Shem Ha'echad Gereshom, that one of the children's names was Gereshom, Ki Amar, because he said, Ger Hayiti Be'eres Nochriya, because I was a stranger in a foreign land. Gereshom, Ger Sham, I was a stranger in a foreign land. Veshem Ha'echad Eliezer, and the other child's name was Eliezer, Ki Elohe Abi Be'ezri, because God was by my side, He aided me. Vayatzileni mecherev Paron, He saved me from Paro's sword. Paro tried to kill Moshe, and Moshe miraculously got saved. So he named his second son Eliezer. God saved me from Paro. Now you're going to tell me that these two pesukim that talk about Moshe's two children have messages? Have applicable messages that we could learn? Rabbi, you got so much material in this parasha. Don't try to squeeze out of these pesukim lessons. I'm going to tell you tonight, Be'ezrat Hashem, three different lessons that are vital that can be drawn out from these pesukim, and I want you to learn from this, maybe even more important than the lessons itself. Learn from this how rich our Torah is. You learn from this never to discount the pasuk of the Torah. Never to say, continue further. There's nothing we can get out of this. The Torah is rich. It's like a saturated oil field. That no matter where you're going to dig, there's going to be a geyser that comes out. There's no piece of the Torah that doesn't have underneath its surface a wealth of lessons, and a wealth of musar, and a wealth of teaching and instruction. But you just have to dig a little. Once you find it, it's endless. Every pasuk is like that. This pasuk is no different. The question is obvious. Don't we know the names of Moshe Rabbeinu's children already? And don't we know why he named them what he named them? I mean, this is ancient history. The Torah told us already when they were born. He had a son called Gereshom, Ki Amar Gerayiti Be'eres Nochriya. That was already written in Perashat Shemot. And we know he had a second son called Eliezer, and we know the reason why he was called Eliezer. So what does the Torah have to reintroduce to me the children, and not only reintroduce to me their names, but giving me the history, why they were named? I mean, let me give you an example. Imagine you were bringing your grandchild to visit his grandfather. Would you tell the grandfather, "Grandpa, this is your grandchild Yosef that we named after you"? But the kid's 14 years old. The grandfather knows already that there's a sister already. Every time you're going to bring him, "This is Yosef, you know, the one we named after you." We know that's right. Yosef, that's not. How many times are you going to repeat it? Here already, the Torah, it's over the story. "Oh, you should know, this is Gereshom because ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, this is Eliezer because so-so." Why does the Torah repeat? I heard an amazing explanation. This explanation applies more to me than to you. And I'll tell you from the onset, it applies to me and I'm guilty of it. So I'm definitely not the one to come preach this theory. So actually I'm talking to myself for the next couple of minutes. I'm just going to talk out loud, and you want to listen to me, you want to tune out, you don't want to take notes, I'm not offended. If anybody wants to go to the bathroom, this would be a good time to go. But there's a great Musar over here. Yitro now is coming back to see his son-in-law Moshe embarking on a new career. He's embarking upon a career where he is going to become the greatest leader of a people in history of the world. He's going to lead 3 million Jews in the Midbar with all their trials and tribulations and their questions. And he's going to have to deal with the Sibur. And Yitro's a very perceptive, he's a wise man. He says, "I understand Moshe Rabbeinu's test. It's the test of every public servant and every leader. The leader gets so consumed and so involved in worrying about the people that unfortunately who gets neglected? His own family. While the leader's out giving the classes and teaching and going and organizing and making and doing, but it's possible that his own children can be neglected." As the saying goes, something like, you know, the shoemaker's shoes, the shoemaker's children don't have shoes. They're walking around barefoot because the shoemaker's so busy making shoes for everybody else, so he doesn't have time for us to make shoes for his kids, or something like that. So you see, Yitro wanted to convey a message to Moshe. "Moshe, it's great that you're working for the Sibur. Hazak u'baruch, very important. But don't forget the individual. Your children are individuals. Don't sacrifice the individuals, your family, the expense of the Sibur, because they're important." And Yitro subtly, very subtly, conveys that message by telling Moshe, "Moshe, here's your first son, Gereshom. Remember why you called him Gereshom? Because you said, Ger Hayiti, Be'eres Nochriya. Because you commemorated, you said, I was a stranger in a foreign land and God took care of me. You were an individual when God took care of you. You didn't have a big nation behind you. You didn't have a big following. It wasn't Gerim Hayinu. It was in the individual. It was in the singular tense. Ger Hayiti. And God took care of you. The individual is important. And your second son was Eliezer. And you remember why you called him Eliezer? Ki Elohe Abi Be'ezri Vayatzileni. There wasn't a whole nation in danger. There wasn't a whole people that was going to Ben Menan be annihilated. There was one individual man called Moshe that was in trouble, and God saved you to show you the individual has value. Moshe, the message to you is, take care of the Sibur. But don't forget the Yachid also has a great value in our... And you know it. Because
you were the benefactor of the individual attention that God had with you, and look what came out. And you even said it, Ker Haiti Vayatzileni, in the singular. So like every other father-in-law that can't wait to impart advice to his son-in-law, in this case Yitro did it. It's not a bad lesson to fathers-in-law to learn how Yitro gave over the advice. He wasn't an imposing man. He said it over in a nice way. But then I'll give it over to him in a hint. If he gets the hint, good. If he doesn't get the hint, I'll leave him alone. I'm not gonna drive him crazy with it. The Brisker Rav once said, and I paraphrase, that Kiruv begins at home. Which means that we can get caught up in trying to bring back the whole Jewish people back to God. And you can make the whole world religious. And the only people that are not religious are the rabbi's children. Because the rabbi never had a chance, or the leader never had a chance to tell them also about it, because he neglected them. So this you see over here is a great lesson. And just like we say charity begins at home, Kiruv begins at home also. And that's the way he explains when Avraham throws out Yishmael. He tells Yishmael, get your bags, get out. He throws them out on his head. So he asks the question, what do you mean he throws out Yishmael? Wasn't Avraham Avinu the epitome of Echnasat Orim? Avraham doesn't throw out people. Avraham's the one that brings in people. Wayfarers, strangers, Arabs. He doesn't discriminate. His doors are open for all race, all the denomination. And now, the one that has open door policy, Avraham, he takes his friend, throws him out the door. And the explanation, the Brisker Rav says, is because Avraham knew the rules. Yes, he's a public figure. Yes, he has sibur. He has responsibilities to the masses. But first, he must get his house in order. And Yishmael ruins the house of Yaakov Avraham Avinu. Yishmael is a spoiled, he's a rotten seed. He spoils Yitzhak, he spoils the home. And therefore, while we have to bring people and we have to, but the house must be in order. Avraham did not compromise his personal family, the expense of his job that he had for the Sibur. That's the first message that the Pasuk is coming to tell leaders. Don't forget about your wife. Don't forget about your children. See to it also that their spirituality is in order while you take care of the wholesale. So you got to take care of the wholesale department and the retail department. You got to take care of both departments simultaneously. Don't devote yourself only to the wholesale, but you have to come home once in a while. I know my wife's going to hear this tape and she's going to kill me. You told them that. I'm telling you from the beginning. I'm cooked after this chiddush. But that's, you can come to this, know that you'll hear the truth. Now, even if I'm not following it, I'm not going to sketch you. I'm not going to sell you things. Most of the things, unfortunately, I can't say that I'm following, but this one, unfortunately, maybe Bezat Hashem, I'll listen to the tape after that Rico makes it, maybe it'll sink in. You know, when you're saying it, it doesn't sink in like when you hear it. I'll listen to it again. Hatati. The Baal HaTurim has a comment on these Pesukim. The Baal HaTurim says, he makes an observation. He says, when it comes to Moshe's first son, the Torah says, Shemai Had Gereshom, the first boy is called him, Ki Amar, because he said Geraiti. The second son, it just says, his name was Eliezer, because God saved him. He says, what does it mean, Ki Amar? The first son was called Gereshom because he said Geraiti. When it comes to the second son, it doesn't say because he said, it just says because. He said. We say with a reason. Not to say he said Ki Amar. What is the Ki Amar over here? That's his question. So he says an astounding fact. Most people don't know it. But there was a prenuptial agreement between Moshe and Yitro. Yitro put a condition on the marriage. He says, you want to marry my daughter, Sipporah? I have conditions. So you're thinking, you know, Syrian mentality, what can be his conditions? You know, you have to make a certain amount of money a year. You have to live on a certain block. You have to drive a certain car. You have to come with us to deal. You have to come with us to Turnberry. You can't. What can you throw on? Yeah, you have to come spend Midian. Come to Midian for the summer. What can he ask? He asked something amazing. He says, "All right, you want my daughter? The first son that's born, Avodah Zarah. You have to raise him up in the church. Bring him up in the church." Shemai say. Are you out of your mind, Yitro? Are you crazy? And mind you, this is talking about Yitro after he converted. This is after Yitro became Baal Teshuvah, after he went and he denounced all the idolatry, after he comes along, he took off his Pope hat, he put on a black hat, he became religious, he became Jewish, he became everything. We expect such talk from Yitro. Yitro should tell his son-in-law Moshe, you want to marry my daughter, you better send your kids to yeshiva. They better study all day long in the kollel. Don't let them make the same mistakes that I made. And here he comes along with a totally different approach. He says, no, the first son you have to set aside for Avodah Zarah. And the Baal HaTurim goes on to say, and he tells Moshe as if, and you know, you have to listen to me because you're a stranger in a foreign land. So, you know, I have leverage over you. You know, I'm taking care of you over here. So he learns the pasuk as if to say, the first son was called Gereshom Ki Amar because Yitro said, Ger Hayiti Be'eres Nochriya. Yitro tells Moshe, listen, you're a stranger, so you know you got to follow the rules. And Moshe acquiesces. That's the bigger hiddush. Moshe says, deal. Moshe is thinking, is all right. He'll pacify Yitro, placate to him a little. Eventually, he'll win him over, and Yitro will say, "Okay, pass." So Moshe thinks that this is maybe a way to mekarev Yitro a little. I'll agree with him temporarily. It should be pointed out, by the way, interestingly, when Gereshom is born, he's not circumcised. You remember when they were going down to Egypt? Then already the angel came and wanted to kill Gereshom because why wasn't he circumcised? Because that was the deal. The first son is for the church. The church they don't circumcise. Only when they left Yitro's domain, then God came to him and says, okay, listen, I understand why you didn't circumcise him when you were in Midian, but now you left, you don't got to follow anymore. There's no more loyalty to Yitro. Circumcise the kid. The question is obvious, what was Yitro thinking? Sort of Chaim Shmuelevitz explains, he gives us a little insight into Yitro's mindset. Yitro would be considered a modern, secular type thinker, where he believed that in order to really appreciate the religion of Torah, the religion of God, Judaism, you have to sample a lot of the other cultures, and you have to taste a lot of the other religions, and experience all that other, the other worlds, and then you'll come to Judaism because you'll see how rational and how logical it is compared to everything else. You can't just go into it by default. Yitro says, that's how I saw God. I tasted everything. I went to every religion, every cult, every... And when I came to Judaism, I said, wow, this makes a lot of sense. I want that same life for my first grandson. I don't want it to be a Jew by default because his father was Jewish, he has to be Jewish. Let him come to it because He understands it and it makes sense. Let him see that the Torah is superior to every other lifestyle. He didn't want Gershom to be narrow-minded. Yitro was a truth seeker. And he found it. So he wanted Gershom to follow the same itinerary that he did. And he'll also, Yitro was confident, he'll also come to the truth. Is Yitro right in his theory? Certainly not. What's the flaw in Yitro's thinking? Why not let the child surf a little into other cultures and then eventually see that our Torah is indeed superior? Well, the first reason is obvious. It's a very risky trip. That's a very risky proposition that Yitro has. And as he's shooting craps. Because what if he doesn't come to the conclusion that his grandfather came? What if he stops at the Moonies and says, this makes a lot of sense. And then he's selling flowers on Ocean Parkway and Church Avenue for the rest of his life. And then what? And then what, Yitro? Then he made a mistake. He didn't come around. You know, it's like the student that once went to his rabbi was a modernist. And he asked the rabbi, can I study comparative religion? And the rabbi said, why not? Certainly, go right ahead. But he says, Rabbi, I'm scared. So the rabbi said, do you fly an airplane? Do you go on a plane? He says, certainly. He says, but the plane could crash. But you go. So you do things in life that are risky. So this is also okay. The student came back 10 years later as a priest wearing a collar. And he told the rabbi the plane crashed. So you see over here, it's certainly a very risky plan that Yitro has. But that's not the only reason why it's dangerous. Even if Yitro would be able somehow to guarantee that Gershom would end up being a religious Orthodox Torah Jew, still it's wrong. What's the flaw? So Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitt says the flaw is that we don't follow the Torah because it's logical and because it makes sense and because we understand it. Ultimately, we follow the Torah because it's the word of God, and we have obedience like servants, and we accept it whether we understand it or not. And if you think about it, a lot of the Torah we cannot give a reason to. Nobody has ever explained to me why we can't eat milk and meat, and I haven't heard a good reason why we can't wear wool and linen called shatnez. Then you want to go to the Parah Aduma, and not even Stam Shelomo HaMelech, that knew the reasons for the other ones, but he waved the flag when it came to Parah Aduma. So you see over here, our Torah is not necessarily a constitution that has logic to it. And there is a logic to it, don't get me wrong, but it's not accessible. It's not always the most rational to our minds. We follow the religion almost blindly. Not to say that you can't ask questions. As a matter of fact, it's probably incumbent to ask questions. Just come to my Gemara class in the morning. You'll see our loyal students take that instruction very seriously. It's hard to ask questions. But it's with the assumption that the law is the law, whether I understand it or not. It's like what we say in the morning in the Tefillah. The morning we say, En Kelohenu, En Kadonenu, En Kimadonenu. There's nobody like God. Finish. End. There's nobody like our God. End of subject. Next story. Period. What's the next line? Mi Kelohenu. You just said a second ago, En Kedoenu. Now you're coming and say, you know what the matter is? Is there anybody like our God? But make up your mind. The explanation is, so long as you say En Kedoenu, so long as you accept it, I don't understand it. Yeah, no. Fact, bedrock faith, En Kedoenu. Now that you accept that as to be true, now you have a right to ask, Ami Kedoenu, because you already accepted it. Yitro's problem was, he came along and said, first ask me Keloenu, and hopefully you'll come to the conclusion of En Keloenu. That's his problem. He flipped it. He was looking at the Torah as something that has to make sense to the human mind, and that's not necessarily the divine law. We explained once that that's the difference between, you know, the four sons that we read about on Pesach. The Chacham, the Rasha, the Tam, and the She'eno Yodei Lishol. Leave the She'eno Yodei Lishol, because he doesn't ask any questions. He's the most boring out of the three. He doesn't talk so much. The Chacham asks a question. The Rasha asks a question. The Tam asks a question. But obviously, somewhere in their question, from the way they asked it, we were able to decide he's the wise man, he's the bad guy, and he's the simpleton. I want to know what word was used in the Hakam's question that they decided he's the Hakam. And what did the Rasha say that they said he's the Rasha, and what did the Tam say? So I saw an explanation that says one word. There's one word that the Hakam uses and the Tam uses that the Rasha doesn't use. And what is that word? The word is Mahar. So that in introducing the Hakam's question, it says, and when your son will come and ask you tomorrow. When it comes to the simpleton's question, and when your son will ask you tomorrow. When it comes to the Rasha, doesn't say the word tomorrow. When your son will ask you. Implying today. What's the difference? Why does Mahar make all the difference in the world? Because picture the scene. You're sitting at the night of the Seder, you have the Matzah, you got the Maror, you got the Korban, a lot of things going on. The Hakam is sitting at the table and everybody's eating the Matzah. He says, hey fellas, what in the world are you eating Matzah for? What kind of business is this? What's the reason? What's the logic? So the father says, listen. There's a logic to it. Trust me, there's a logic. But there's no time for us to give you the whole Torah now over the night. Said you have to eat the matzah by 12 o'clock. Do me a favor. I'll give you the reason. The Hakam says, fine. I don't need the reason today. Give me the reason mahar. I'll give you a matzah. I'll eat the matzah. No problem. The Hakam is a Hakam because he accepts even before he understands. He's willing to wait until mahar for his answer. Till tomorrow. The Rasha is different. The Rasha sees everybody fulfilling the ritual. He says, what is the reason for this? So we can't explain it to you now. We'll explain it to you tomorrow. Tomorrow, go jump in the lake. I'm not eating no matzah. Until I can understand it, I don't follow. Till it makes sense, I'm not interested. The Rasha says, mi keloenu. The Hakam says, en keloenu. Then he has a right to ask. Mi keloenu. Yitro subscribe to that other approach. He said, search, look, logic, question. In our religion, you only have to search if you're missing something. Yitro had no choice to search because his father was lost, and therefore he had to find himself. But Gideshom, his father was grounded. Moshe Rabbeinu knew exactly. He had the emet. Why do I have to go search for a new raincoat if I have one that's working fine? You know, the guy that's getting wet in the rain, so let him go search for a raincoat. I don't got to go do that. It's a waste of time for me. But the main lesson that we bring out over here is the Torah actually is divine. Even, let's see if we're going to convey this point to you. Even the stuff in the Torah that you think you understand, like in the Aseret Dibro, don't kill.
That's logical. Come on, Rabbi, don't kill. I don't need a Torah to tell me that. It's nice that Torah wrote it. But don't kill is, go ask any goy in the street. Like, killing, our government will put you in jail if you kill, by the way. So you didn't need a Torah to tell you don't kill. I am telling you that just like milk and meat is divine and we can't understand it, that's the way you have to look at don't kill also. Why? Because look what happened. Look what happened to the nations that put a rationale behind don't kill. In the 1940s, even earlier, abortion was unheard of. Infanticide, euthanasia, all these terminologies, these gross terminologies that we're learning today, assisted suicide, all these terminologies that we read about and they're being grappled in the courts. In the early 1900s, all these things were forbidden to kill. You know why they didn't kill in the early 1900s? Because they had a problem. They needed people. They needed population. So they said, we can't do it. But now the year 2002, that there's overpopulation and there's so many people in the world. Now already, what happens? Now we redefine what it means don't kill. So abortion becomes the law of the land. Pro-choice becomes... So what does that tell you? That when you use your logic, when man puts a logic to even the most simple of laws, it's not absolute anymore. In one generation, they won't kill, in the next generation, they will kill. So the reason why we don't kill is because God said. Now, once God said, finish, over. But, God said, finish, over. But why? Now why? God said, next time, put your head down and follow it. So in truth, everything in the Torah that we're following, even the stuff we understand, you're following it not because you understand it. Because once you think you understand it, then you'll figure out a case where you can break the law. Don't steal. Don't steal. Why? Because it's cruel. But if I steal from the rich to give to the poor, that's what communism said. Communism didn't think they were stealing, the communists. They said, we're doing a good thing. We're helping the poor class. But the Jew comes up and says, don't steal. Forget about the reason. God said, don't steal. Finished. Next subject. Over. It's divine. It's like shot this. It's absolute. That was Yitro's problem. Yitro was looking at the Torah from a secular standpoint. He was looking from it, reasons, the why, the what. And that's what he wanted for his grandson. But of course, we don't subscribe to that approach. So that's the second lesson we learn from the Torah telling us about the children of Moshe. And now the third and final lesson. Why did he name them those names? If you think about it, Gidishom, if he would have an English name, Gidishom, would probably be Stranger. It's a funny name. Eliezer would be, God save me from a close near-death experience. So that's like, you call him Savior, Saved, Near-Miss, a funny name. It's a funny name to name your kid. Why would he do that to them? Everybody in Midian is calling Moshe's son, Stranger, come here, Stranger. What is Stranger? What was your father thinking when he named you that name, Stranger? You're a citizen of the land, a stranger. So I saw an explanation from a rabbi called the Perdes Yosef. Fascinating. He says, the children of Moshe had a certain benefit and pleasure that no Jew had at that time. I mean, all the other Jews at the time were living in Egypt. They were slaves.
They were working. They were tortured. They certainly knew that they were in exile. They didn't need to be reminded that they were not in the opportune situation. When they were woken up in the morning at the crack of dawn and beaten in order to build buildings that eventually were going to crumble down, when they were psychologically tortured and beaten, the Jews didn't need to be reminded that they're in Galut, in exile. Egypt was a clear exile. But the only two kids that might fall into a trap into thinking that they're okay, were Moshe's children, because they lived in Midian. There was freedom in Midian. They had their grandfather, their grandparents. They were able to come and go as they wanted. They had respect, they had honor. And Moshe Rabbeinu didn't want them to get fooled by their comfort, that they should forget that they are also in exile. They are also not in the opportune situation. Therefore, he calls his son Gerishom, stranger. It's not your land. You're a guest. Don't forget it. And then he calls his second son Eliezer. He tells his second son, you know, God saved me from Paro's sword. But you know who I was? I was the prince of Egypt. I was born in the palace. I was raised in the palace. I had privileges. I had rights. And all of a sudden, overnight, the king wanted to kill me. The Jew is never safe no matter where he is, at any time. Of course, it can always turn. It can always change. So he called his son Eliezer to instill into the son what can happen to a Jew in Galut, and you can't forget that you're in Galut, and you can't take for granted your existence in Galut. As a matter of fact, it's miraculous that the Jew can live in Galut. As comfortable as it may seem, our existence in exile is actually a miracle. Of course, history proves this time in and time out again. Whether it was the Jews in Spain that lived quite comfortably and had rights and freedoms and were on top, Rav Shmuel HaNagid, great friend of the King Ferdinand. And then, of course, on a dime, the Jews were reminded that they were in exile. Tisha B'Av in 1492, the Inquisition of the Jewish people, the expulsion of the Jewish people of Spain. They were all kicked out. Get out, leave, you're not wanted, go, don't come back. And if Spain is too far back in history for you to remember the lesson of the Jew in exile, you can go back to the 1930s of the Jews in Germany. Where on a dime, the exile had enough of the Jew and said to the Jew, pack your bags and leave, get out. Those that didn't make it out, the Germans saw to it that they were snuffed out and killed. Haman Nesila. And that's what Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to instill in his children. Don't think you're living in Midian, you're comfortable, you think things are good. Us people in Egypt will never forget. We know how bad it is. But you have to remember, Gerishom, you're a stranger. Eliezer, remember that I had it great in Egypt and I was almost killed. It can happen at any time. And that's what we read in the Haggadah Shel Pesach. We lift up our cups. What does it mean in that paragraph over there? We say, Shelo echad bilvad amad alenu lechalotenu. There was not one isolated incident where there was a tyrant that rose up to try to solve the final solution, what to do with the Jews. It wasn't an isolated case. Ela bechol dor vador.
every generation throughout history, omdim aleinu lechalotenu. You have to know that the tyrants are plotting and planning and scheming to rid the world from the Jews. V'kadosh baruch hu matzilenu biyadam, but God always comes through and saves us. And we in America read that verse and we smile to ourselves and say, it's an exaggeration. It's not here. Yeah, that was Germany. Okay, we don't know exactly what caused it. But this is America. Yeah, Spain, we heard stories. Okay, it's an example. That's history. But Bechol Dor Vador, America? It's not us. After all, look at where the Jews have, where they have come from, and where they have reached in this country. We're considered an official ethnic minority. We're on the charts. It's a minyan of Jews in the House of Representatives, and you have more than a zimun in the Senate. You have Jews in the highest levels in all walks of life. Business, professional, the arts. Omdim aleinu lechalotenu, destroy us. We're running the country, not here. So the Gaon de Vilna says, oh, Jew in America, you better read the next paragraph in Agadah. Because you learn an important lesson. The next paragraph says, Tse ulmad. Go out and learn. What do you mean go out and learn? I'm sitting in my house now. I got to go out and learn? What are you talking about? Go out and learn. You go out and learn. The explanation is, Tse ulmad. Leave your dream world. Leave your complacency. Leave your fairy tales. Tse. Wake up. Ulmad. Go learn a story in the Torah, and after you learn the story, you come back and see if your attitude didn't change. What's the story? Listen to the story, what Yaakov wanted to do to Lavan. Hard to believe. What happened? Not perfect. What happened was, Lavan comes to Yaakov comes to Lavan's house. The day Yaakov gets there, Lavan starts to become wealthy. Yaakov's a loyal worker. Yaakov marries four daughters of Lavan, supports them properly, brings Lavan grandchildren, boys, girls. He only brought Lavan kavod, he brought him honor, he brought him success, everything good. Yaakov Abinu is living very, very good relations with him and his father-in-law. And he's there for 21 years. I mean, it's a long time. And all of a sudden the Torah comes along and says, one morning Yaakov Abinu gets up, Vayishma et divrei b'nei Lavan nemor. Overnight, he hears the children of Lavan murmuring to each other. Lakach Yaakov et kol asher le'avinu. All Yaakov's money is stolen. It belongs to our father. He's a crook. All right, what happened? We're living. It's fine. No problems. All of a sudden, the anti-Semitic children, the anti-Semitic genes floated to the top, and they start having claims. What do you think he became so wealthy from? It's from us. He duped us. He saw Lavan's face. He never saw this side of Lavan. It was never like this. So he calls an emergency meeting. Look at this. He calls an emergency meeting of his wives. Come to the field. Daniel, your father wants to kill us. What? Kill us? Yeah. Not only us. Me, you, the children. There's going to be a holocaust over here. We gotta flee. We got to get out of here. Okay, let's go. They have to run like fugitives. And Lavan finally catches up with Yaakov and tells him his intention. He says, you know what? I was going to kill you. I was going to kill you, the children, everybody.
But God came to me last night in a dream and said, I better not. And that's the only reason why I'm not doing it. So the Gaon of Vilna says, Se'ul Nad, complacent Jew. Go read a story, what happened to Yaakov Avinu. It happened. You'd never think it could happen to Yaakov. But at the end of the day, after 21 years living, not a problem, all of a sudden he's running for his life. Laban wants to kill him. So it can happen. So what's the lesson from this third Chiddush of the Naim? Should we renew our passports? Is that the lesson over here? Certainly don't want anybody to have nightmares and get scared. I'm certainly not giving America any good ideas either. What's the lesson? The lesson is you can't forget that you're in exile. It's hard to imagine that this is a galut in America. It's hard to imagine that this is really an exile. Usually has in it a lot of negative connotation. But in America, it's malchut shel chesed. There hasn't been a bigger proponent for Judaism than America. Since the inception of the world, since civilization, how much money they give to support the yeshivot and Torah and institutions. They're a country in the world that lets us block the streets with police protection so we can dance with a sefer Torah. We can open up synagogues on any block and open up as many yeshivot as we want and kolelim. The Jews have a problem with us opening up yeshivot, maybe, but the government has no problem. America's open up all the Torah you want. It's the Jews that we have to fight with. But America? God bless America. That being said, it's still galut. It's still exile. And you can't forget that. And the Satmar Rav once was in Miami, and he was sitting under a palm tree, and it's a nice sunny day, and he's drinking a lemonade. And he turns to one of the students and he says, this is galut. And then he says, but if you have to be in galut, this is where to be. So there's no question, America is a sweet galut. But galut nonetheless. And you can't forget it. Gereshom. You can't forget we're strangers in a foreign land. What is our responsibility then? Our responsibility would be what the Gemara in Baba Batra says. I think from a story in Gemara, Baba Batra, we can draw a lesson on the agenda of how a Jew is supposed to carry himself in a foreign land that's not his. The Gemara Babatra on page Ayin Gimal Amud Bet. Listen to an amazing story. Ve'amar Abba Bar Bar Hana Zimna Hada one time Havaka Azlinan Bisfinata. One time we were riding on a boat. The Hazina Nahu Chavra, we saw a whale, a big fish. We didn't know it was a fish, we didn't know it was a whale, because the Yatbale Halta Agaba, because on its back there was all sand. Savrina Yaveshtahi. So we thought it was an island. So we got off the boat, Vesalkinan. And we made a barbecue on the island, Ubachlinan. We started making a whole gourmet thing with fire and everything. Vekadham Gaber, and all of a sudden it seems the whale's back started to get a little hot from all the sarchicha, from all the shawarma. It hapich. So it turned over. And we almost drowned. The ilav dava mekarmasa finta. And if the boat wasn't close to us, havat tabana, we would have drowned. End of story. What in the world is Gemara telling us? Is this what? This is, yeah, Rabbah's coming on saying, so you know what I did on winter vacation? We went with the boys on a boat, on a cruise, and the, what kind of Gemara is this over here? This is not a diary of Rabbah's personal stories over here, but a fish story the Gemara is telling us? How he made a barbecue, and they cooked, and they went. This is not a joke, this is a Gemara. And the Gemara's writing this story, it's got to be a lesson over here. Always know a rule. In all these stories of the Gemara, there's always hidden messages. Gemara doesn't waste its time with telling us personal. Hey, we went to Aruba, we came back, the flight was delayed. It's not idle chat, Hashem shows the Gemara. So the Gaon of Vilna says, brilliant. He says, the boat in the stormy sea represents the Jew living in exile, and the whale that looked like an island represents also the exile, but the tranquil exile. And what happens? You get off the boat and you say, ah! Finally we found an exile that will accept us. Finally we found peace. So you sit on the island. What happens? The Jew starts to make a lot of noise on the island. He feels at home. He takes out his skillet. He takes out his barbecue. He takes out his music. His car, his hat. He starts enjoying himself. And all of a sudden the fish starts to become uncomfortable. And then the galut spits the Jew out and says, get out of here. And if they weren't close to the boat, if they weren't close to the Torah, he says, they would drown. A great lesson. The Gemara is coming to tell you what exactly incites the goyim of the Jews in exile. And we've seen this fish turn over. Was there anybody more influential in Spain than Don Isaac Abarbanel, who was the finance minister, the closest man to King Ferdinand? With all their poets and their musicians. But what happened in Spain? On that island, that dream island that the Jewish people thought they were on, the fish turned over. And in Germany, the same, where the Jews were saying at one point, Berlin is Jerusalem. And the fish turned over. The lesson of the Gemara is that the Jew in exile must have a low profile. Something that we're not used to hearing in our community. Low key. Goes against everything we're taught. Hey, low key? What do you mean low key? We have to let everybody know what we're doing and how much we spend and where we came from and what we bought and how much we have. We're very high profile people. We like everybody to know everything about us. Hard for us to keep things under our hats. It's a bad thing, even Jews to Jews, but when the goyim see it and you stick it in their face, they resent it. The Kli Yakar writes on a pasuk, Torah tells us in Devarim, couldn't wait till Devarim to tell it to you, so I'll tell it to you now. The Kli Yakar is writing on a pasuk, the God tells the Jewish people, Penu lachem safona, which means what? Travel north. Again, easy pasuk. Penu lachem safona, travel north. Comes the Kli Yakar and learns from this pasuk, go north. Penu lachem safona, oh, what a lesson, he says. Lomar, he says, safona can also be read safun. Safun means God is telling the Jewish people, go hidden. Don't go high profile. Penu lachem tzafona. Keep it low key. And he says,
נראה לומר שאם נמסה איש הישראלי בגלות החיל הזה, איזה הצלחה. If the Jews are somewhat successful in their foreign land, אז יתמינו ויצפינו הכל. Cover it up. Don't let them know you're successful. Because according to the Goyim, everything we own, the money in our pocket is theirs. Because they hold that we fooled Esav and we stole the blessings and all this is theirs. And if you show it and you dangle it in front of them, they come along like lies and it's ours. Give it back. And Yishmael thinks the same thing. They say, Yitzhak sketched Yishmael out of the blessings. Yishmael was the oldest. And Yitzhak comes along and takes the blessings. And therefore the Kli Yakar writes, be very inconspicuous. Our religion is never, Judaism, Torah is never pro-hype. It's so anti-hype, so anti-public posture. It despises it. Akedat Yitzhak, the greatest act in history. How many people were there? Two. Abraham and Yitzhak. The greatest events in Jewish history always happened low-key, private, without any hype. The Kohen Gadol in the Holy of Holies on Kippur. How many people are there? Just him and God alone. The most holy moment of the year for the Jewish people happens alone, in solitude. There's no helicopter over the Kodesh Kodeshim giving an aerial play-by-play what the Kohen is doing. And the events that took place with hype were doomed. Even Matan Torah, even the giving of the Torah. We all know about the first set of tablets. They ended up being shattered into a million pieces. You know why, the Gemara says? Because it was given with hype. It was given with noise, with action, with preparation, with things, with people, laughs, clouds, thunder. It was too noisy. Too noisy. Not gonna. When were the second tablets given? Who knows even? What second tablet? We know we have them. We know we got them. But when? Where was the party? When did we celebrate it? Was it on a mountain? Did it? Torah doesn't even give us details of that. That's why those were the keepers. The second luchot are the keepers because it was done low-key. It's written in the Torah, it's hinted somewhere, okay, that's it. Keep it under your hat. That's a Jewish policy in general. Certainly when you're not living in your homeland, to come and flaunt. And to talk and to brag and to show. You know, God forbid, we suffered great tragedy on September 11th. But you have to keep in mind the Twin Towers. Two tall buildings they were. High exposure. Very open. Gotta be careful. So that tells you, things of high profile, open. The luchot were given. That's the shadow. It's not our way. We're scared of that. Unfortunately, in our community, we haven't learned that lesson to an extent. Like the Kli Yakar says in his time, now this is written in the 16th century. It could have been written an hour ago. The ink is still wet on this Kli Yakar. He says, I want to quote it inside. He says, "V'zehefek mimashi Yisrael osin bedorot talaut." It's the opposite of what the Jews are doing in our time. Be'arzoto ibehem ki mi sheyesh lo, mi sheyesh lo maneh. If a person has 100. He dresses himself in fancy clothes and builds big conspicuous houses. It's not enough. He has 100, but he makes everybody have the impression that he has 1,000. Umegarima umot pe'atzmam, and they incite the Goyim against us. So the agenda of the Jewish people in Galut is certainly low profile. The Ashkenazim, to a certain degree, that went through the Holocaust know this lesson. Even the ones that are of stature and have wealth, they live very low key. You wouldn't even know they have anything. And you ask them why, because we learned the lesson. We know what gets the Goyim angry. We know what gets the fish heated. In Rhode Island, I have a synagogue called the Touro Synagogue. They also have the mansions. It's a big difference, obviously, between the mansions and the Touro Synagogue. The mansions look like mansions, but the Touro Synagogue doesn't look like a synagogue from the outside. It looks like a regular, plain old house. The Jews that came from Spain built that synagogue. And the reason why they built the synagogue the way they did is because they learned the lesson. Even in the religion, don't flaunt it. Don't show it so much. Keep it inconspicuous. They don't have to know it's a synagogue. And in the synagogue, something very interesting. The Goyim can build their big mansion. It's not a problem for them. The synagogue, they kept it a little inconspicuous. But in the synagogue itself, under the teva where the hazan stands, there's a trap door. You open up the door and you can escape from underground out of the synagogue. And they built it because they learned the lesson from Spain. That there's no guarantees in Galut and it can change at any time. They learned the lesson of Lavana Arami. Unfortunately, like I said, in our community, this trait must be worked on. To talk so much. What do you have and what you have and what you do. It's a modesty in speech, keeping things to yourself. You don't have to let everybody know what and where. I don't know if this was related or not to anything we're talking about, but just another point. I was in one of the yeshivot this week at the girls' school before I taught my class. And I heard all the girls are talking in the hallway. And the famous question that was asked, the million-dollar question after winter vacation, where did you go? And I was very offended by this question. So I began the class and I said, girls, I want to make it very clear to you. It is not a sin to go away for winter vacation. By no means is it a sin. You have to know that. But I want to remind you, by no means is it a mitzvah either to go away for winter vacation, nor a minhag. What does it mean, the question, where did you go? That assumes that for sure you have to go somewhere. That's the minhag, you have to go. This is deen. I mean, I don't have to ask you, did you blink today? You have to blink. Or did you eat? That's a given. What did you eat? Or where did you eat? But you had to go away for winter vacation. This is peshita, maika mashmalan. The question is where? So I said, to me, this is not a fair question. And if a girl would answer, I stayed home. Oh, Hazita, she stayed home. You poor thing. What a terrible trap. You probably had the worst time. And everybody flaunting their suntans, and everybody flaunting their pictures. And it's not a sin to go away. But it's not Jewish to stick it in everybody's face and let everybody know and where and why. It's too much talk. Too much. Go away. Enjoy it. You went away to talk about it, or you went away to relax? So I said, girls, you're probably thinking, the rabbi's just burning because he didn't go away with it. I thought about that. It's not so. We were involved in better things. We're having babies. We were doing much more important things. But that's part of the same thing. We're not telling you don't live. By all means, live. live by your means, according to your means. That's not the point. But it's gotta be to yourself. Keep it to yourself. It doesn't have to be public. And certainly, it doesn't have to be the knowledge of the groom. When the New York Times has to write that, you know, there was a bar mitzvah on the Queen Elizabeth, the big boat. This is too much, too much, too much. When that becomes the party of parties, a Jewish bar mitzvah, or a Jewish wedding, etc., etc. It's too... It's roasting on the back of the fish. And that's what Moshe Rabbeinu was trying to teach his children. You're in Midian. You don't know what suffering is. You don't know what bondage is. You don't know what slavery is. You have it good. You have your family. You have everything. But you're strangers, and it can change at any time. I had to flee from the sword of Paro. Three lessons we learn from the most obnoxious pasuk in the parasha. Yitro was telling his son-in-law, don't forget the individual. You're working for Sibur, don't forget your kids. God took care of you as an individual. Secondly, we learn of Yitro's approach to religion, ki amar. We learn his approach is a rational approach, while Moshe's approach is a more obedient approach. And thirdly, we learn that the Jew can never be complacent in the galut that he finds himself, and he must be low-key and to himself, not to incite others against him. Baruch Adonai L'olam. Amen. Amen.